Case number 21-3680, Jeffrey Cox versus Franklin County, Ohio Board of Commissioners. Oral argument is not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Newman, you may proceed for the appellant.
Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Justin Newman. I am here representing appellate Jeffrey Cox. And before I begin, I'd like to request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Okay. Appellate Cox seeks reversal of the District Court's May 21, 2021 summary judgment order and a remand for further proceedings. The review of the summary judgment order is done de novo, and this court must construe all reasonable inferences in Mr. Cox's favor in ruling on this appeal.
Well, counsel, before we get, I'm sorry to break your flow, but we got a response to a motion last night you filed a motion to substitute Mr. Cox's wife for Mr. Cox. But then we got a response to that motion that indicates that the interest in the real property that was the cause, at least of part of Mr. Cox's injuries, doesn't exist anymore. Neither Mr. Cox nor his wife own the real property anymore. So I guess my first question out of the box is this case moot? And if not, why not?
Your Honor, the case is not moot. You were quite right. Yesterday, the defendant filed a response to our motion. At the time of Mr. Cox's passing, in the district court, there were two bases for standing. At the time of his passing, he still had standing under one of those bases, which was the recreational standing. He was still using the same streams that were affected by the illicit discharges. He was still frequenting the areas that gave rise to standing in the district court. So that basis for standing still survives.
How can that basis for standing survive? Because, if we granted the relief that you request, which would be that ultimately the idea is the water would be cleaned up, mm-hmm. It's very tragic, but you're client can't use the waters anymore, and I don't see an affidavit in here that his wife uses the. How does that claim survive?
Okay. Your Honor, that speaks to the issue of survivability, the issue of survivability allows Ms. Cox, if the claim survives, the Clean Water Act claim survive, to stand in the shoes of Mr. Cox's standing at the time that he passed away. And
isn't his interest in using the waters, that's the way he got standing in this case, and that's personal to him.
And he had that standing at the time of the death. And under the case law on survivability, if the claim survives, then the representative assumes his standing for purposes of carrying the case forward.
But isn't that usually in cases where there's some relief that could be granted? So, for example, there's a payout that it could be a fine or it could be damages or something that would go to the estate or to the survivor. But here we're talking about injunctive relief. Mm-hmm. So there seem to be very few cases on the question of, survivability as it intersects with mootness. But I found a case from the Third Circuit, and it involved a claim for reinstatement. It was a employment discrimination claim or a claim of maybe a labor law claim. And so the claim was for reinstatement. Mm-hmm. And the Third Circuit said, well, even though you filed a motion to substitute someone as a representative, you can't reinstate the deceased. So the claim is moot. How is this case different than that case?
Not familiar.
Now, then again, it's a Third Circuit. Right. I'm asking you to, like, sure. It's kind of unfair. I'm asking you to distinguish a case you haven't read because it wasn't in the briefs.
Sure.
But
well,
do your best.
In the nature of, with an environmental claim, those claims have been, you're essentially, as a citizen plaintiff, you're representing the broader societal interest to serve a remedial purpose. You're trying to get the waters cleaned up. You're seeking penalties to deter future unlawful conduct. And so as a citizen plaintiff, Mr. Cox, and with Ms. Cox assuming his standing, the case isn't moot because there still are 1,700 illegal HSTSs and waters of the use that can still be cleaned up.
How can she assume his constitutional standing? So if at the beginning of the lawsuit she had been the plaintiff, let's say he had not been the plaintiff, and she had been the plaintiff and she didn't put in an affidavit that said, I like to use the waterways, I study them, my fish, or whatever. She didn't have such a claim. And your opponent said, well, she doesn't have standing. I think we would say, you're right, she doesn't have standing. She has to have an injury in fact. So how is it different? I mean, now...
I think that's...
Why isn't the claim extinguished?
I think that's wrong under the law, because I think under the test for survivability on the cases is that the personal representative is assuming the standing of the decedent. So I don't think she has to have Article III standing. She would be assuming the Article III standing. That's the nature of being a personal representative, and I think that's clear in the case law, and that's why environmental claims have been found to survive, Your Honor.
Are there cases like this where claims have survived where the relief is not monetary, it's only injunctive or declaratory, which is basically what, I mean, it's yeah. a penalty, but it's not paid to,
well, and there are,
paid to the United States.
There are actually still three forms of relief that could be sought in this case. One is attorney's fees and litigation costs, which Mr. Cox has spent litigation costs pursuing this case, so there are still monetary damages that could inure to the estate. And then the second is the cleaning up the streams. Those could still inure to his benefit with respect to the fact that he, at the time of his death, he still had standing, was still using the areas. And then the third thing I will note, and I know that opposing counsel filed an affidavit saying that seeking the inference that the standing went away because of the death of Mr. Cox and the move, but the fact is we'll be filing our response and are certainly to assure you that there is standing. We could put on an affidavit from Ms. Cox showing that even at the time of his death, she was using the same. They were both frequenting the same areas that are affected. So even though you don't have to find that she has standing because it's survivability, we can certainly put on an affidavit in response to their challenge to standing to show that both she and Mr. Cox at the time of the death had standing. And so,
yeah, I'm not sure whether that's procedurally proper or not, but we can work that out later.
Yeah, well, I think since they factually have raised the issue, I would like to have a chance to respond factually to it, or maybe it goes to the district court on a remand on the issue. Yes,
Judge. Still live in the area?
What's that?
Does she still live in the area?
She does live in the area. They're still in the same area along the Olentangy River that was affecting them at the time of Mr. Cox's death, and throughout the case, he was still using the areas during the pendency of the entire appeal. Ms. Cox was using the areas along with him during the appeal, and so even though you don't have to reach her separate standing because survivability, I mean, that's the entire point of the survivability test under Federal Rule 43 is that standing of the person who died transfers to the personal representative,
so
and she assumes his.
Survivability, and do you agree that, at least in this circuit, we generally apply a three-part test?
I do. And
how would you, when you apply that test, how do you conclude that it's survivable?
Well, under the, you've got the Murphy, you're alluding to the three-part Murphy test,
right.
And which is used effectively to determine whether the statute is remedial versus penal. And if it's remedial, it survives, and if it's penal, it doesn't survive.
So,
and under the Clean Water Act, under the Murphy test, the first factor for survivability is met because the CWA citizen supervision provides for redress of individual wrongs as well as wrongs to the general, as wrongs to the public. So under that first factor, the courts are looking to see whether there's a benefit that's flowing to the individual as well as to the public, and it collapses into the second prong.
So wait, how would you apply the first?
How would I apply the first factor?
Why is it individual?
Because at the time of his death, the injury, the redress would have benefited if we achieved eliminating these illicit HSTS discharges. At the time of his death, eliminating those would have benefited him as an individual because it would have cleaned up the waterways and resulted in a broader remedial purpose of for the public of cleaning up the waterways. So the individualized benefit in these environmental cases is that his recreational interest would have been protected by redressing the wrong at issue in the case. So that's how that first factor would be applied. And again, under the survivability test, she would assume his standing at the time of his death. I mean, that's the point of the test. And then under the second factor, the Supreme Court has recognized that even with respect to civil penalties and injunctive relief, the fact that it benefits both individuals and members of the public doesn't mean that the second factor isn't met. And in fact, the court has found that civil penalties are specifically do provide redress to individuals and do survive. So even under the Edwards case, which the county was relying on, which held that civil penalties against a defendant don't survive, that's no longer the law. I mean, they were found in the mid-80s to be penal in nature, and under Laidlaw, civil penalties have been found to be remedial in nature because they do result in compliance with the law, and they're not punitive anymore. So that central holding of Edwards, which is the Clean Water Act case that the defendant places much reliance on, under that case, that central holding went away. And even in that case, the defendant was substituted in to carry out the injunctive relief in that case. So the Edwards case doesn't help him on the injunction factor, and then the central point that they're relying on it for finding that civil penalties don't provide redress, that's completely gone away after the Supreme Court's decision in Laidlaw, which came out over a decade later.
Counsel, we've sort of beaten this to death, but I call your attention to a case called Friends of the Earth, the Supreme Court decision, and that case says that the fact that civil penalties are involved means that there is still a redress to be had, mm-hmm. and that in the case they said the Court of Appeals misperceived the remedial potential of civil penalties, and these penalties continue to have value and are important under the Act, notwithstanding that some of the individual things that may have been involved with the person that's now deceased. This was not a deceased case, I might
sure.
add, but the language stressing the survival of civil penalties and the remedial purpose of that, which still exists, seems to me to be relevant to what you've been discussing here today.
Yeah, that's exactly correct, Your Honor. That's the case I was relying on that came out over a decade after Edwards, which is exactly pointing out that the civil penalties, which are another form of relief still being sought in this case, the injunctive relief, and the attorney's fees and costs, are all, because of the nature of the statute, remedial in purpose and not penal. And with a remedial statute, the standing transfers to the surviving representative, and therefore I think that it's not moot.
Going to the merits.
Mm-hmm.
The actual consent order.
Mm-hmm.
In what way? And I understand there are all sorts of arguments about whether it applies before you file and that, but just addressing the consent order, in what way does that not address all of the issues raised in your complaint?
Okay. In particular, Mr. Cox is the only person who sought to enforce eliminating these 2,000 illicit HSTSs that are putting sewage into the county's MS4 system, which it's not designed to handle, and is the only person, the state didn't seek to enforce this, that sought to enforce the illicit sewage discharges coming out of the MS4 system into waters of the U.S. Okay, and as we worked on to appeal, there are at least 1,700 of these that are in no way covered by the consent order.
Wasn't it made clear that the county's interpretation was wrong, and that the question was not whether they were functioning as intended, the question was whether they were discharging?
No, I don't think the county's position has been made clear that it's wrong.
Made clear that the interpretation, that the state's interpretation, which is binding on the county, was not that just because these things were performing as intended at the time that they were grandfathered in. I thought the state made that abundantly clear.
The state has made clear that those are illicit, but the problem is that the consent order takes the county's position and engrafts it into the consent order. If we look at paragraphs 14B, C, D, E, and J of that consent order, you see references over and over to the fact that what's going to be addressed are the failing in discharging, which is essentially the same position that the county has been taking throughout this litigation, which is that we don't have to address the 2,000. What we have to address are only the 2,000 that happen to be failing, and we're not going to eliminate them. We're just going to make a repair and leave them in place to discharge. Now, the record of this case is clear that even if they're failing, or not failing, even if they're not failing, those older systems are still discharging, they're illicit, and they don't have permits, their own permits to discharge into the MS4. And the county's MS4 permit requires them to eliminate those 2,000 discharges into the MS4. But the consent order doesn't have any kind of requirement that any court could enforce that would require the county to eliminate all illicit discharges. Instead, as you look at the language, it's all focused on what are failing. And so essentially, it allows the county to continue to take the same position that it always has, which is the position it's taking in its brief, that we have to correct the ones that are we can only correct the ones that are failing, that are a nuisance, and there's nothing that requires us to get at the 2,000. And I think as you review that consent order, there's nothing that any court could hold the county to that would require them to eliminate all 2,000. And in fact, in the 2019 annual report, which was in front of the district court, which the district court placed a lot of significance on 14J of the consent order, and saying, well, this will be the thing that will result in all this compliance, and construed all kinds of inferences that the county was going to abandon its position, in despite of the fact that in the record, the county continued to flout the law and take the same position. And 14J, which was, again, which is largely a reporting requirement, but was supposedly, according to the district court, going to result in all this compliance. Well, what happened in the first report after the consent decree was filed was that the county didn't list the 1,700 or the 2,000 as illicit discharges for elimination. They listed a whopping two, missed all the other 1,700. And so I think when you put that in with the rest of the record, it was unreasonable for the court, the district court, to construe inferences in the county's favor that this language was going to somehow result in magical compliance, or that you should go around searching for elephants in a mouse hole in 14J that's going to result in compliance. There isn't any language that anybody can enforce and hold the court to. And if I could speak to one other point before I, the other point I would want to make that is that another key error here is that the state carefully selected a number of claims that it was going to bring and a number of claims that it was going to resolve. And those are embodied in that consent order. There were five claims. None of them are seeking to eliminate the illicit discharges, and none of them are going after the 2,000 illegal HSTSs. And under paragraph 7, 9, and I think it's 11 or 12 of the consent order, those three provisions, when read together, it says that the state is only resolving the claims that the state brought. Okay, claims of third parties were not supposed to be affected by the consent order, and in fact, the county agreed that it wouldn't argue that any other claims that weren't raised should have been raised. So, in effect, by finding Mr. Cox's non-overlapping claims, which are broader than what the state brought against the county, the court rewrote the claim preclusion provisions of the consent decree to find the claims that weren't released were released.
Right, but you're well over your time, but I
apologize.
Think what Judge White is getting to is not whether the claims overlap when we look at the complaint, but whether the relief that was achieved by the consent decree eliminates any, provides a remedy for all the claims that your client originally brought. But I think your first answer to Judge White dealt with
that. I think the answer is what resounding no, and that there's a huge gap of non-enforcement that Mr. Cox and his representative could fill.
Does it pertain to those to that group that is performing as intended but inadequately?
I think I missed the first part of your question. Can you repeat it? I'm sorry.
You said it doesn't take care of a set that is performing as intended but is still improperly discharging.
That's correct.
Okay. Is there any other particular claim that is not covered by the consent decree?
Claim 3, which is the unlawful discharges into waters of the U.S. that Mr. Cox has sought to enforce. There's nothing in the consent order that provides any relief for illicit discharges from the MS4 into the streams, and the record's very clear that those are tens of millions of gallons of sewage on an annualized basis that are directly flowing into area waterways. And then I will say that we also briefed the reasons why claims 7, 8, 9 were not resolved by the consent order, and I won't belabor the point, but that's in our briefing. So it's 1, 2, 3, and then 7, 8, 9. 1 and 2 are close cousins of each other. They both address the failure to eliminate these 2,000 HSTSs. So, any other questions?
Nope.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Joe Durham. I represent the Franklin County Board of Commissioners. Before I get to either one of these arguments, I would like to express our condolences to Mr. Cox's family, if any of those members are present or watching. Start with the response that we filed yesterday in regard to the motion for substitution. We had until Friday to respond, but we wanted to get that in front of the court before the oral argument. We are requesting the court to deny the motion for substitution. Mr. Cox no longer has an interest in the outcome of this litigation. Under the Clean Water Act, there's no longer a citizen, as that term is defined under 33 U.S.C. 1365, because that person has to have an interest that may adversely be affected. Neither Mr. Cox or his heirs have an interest in the property. That was a substantial part of Mr. Cox's standing.
Well, what about, though, the whole issue about the remedial effect and that the civil penalties that are involved further the remedial effect and the Clean Water Act? It serves the purposes of the Clean Water Act.
Yeah, Your Honor, when we look at those cases,
that still survives.
When we look at those cases regarding injunctive and declaratory relief, for the most part, they rule that they don't survive unless there is some sort of compensation associated. You indicated the Friends Laidlaw case. That case, and I would disagree with my opposing counsel to say that that overrules the Edwards case. The finding by the Supreme Court in that case went to redressability, and it said that the plaintiffs in that case still had standing. But if you look right after they make that determination, essentially clarifying their earlier position in Steele, they then turn to mootness. And that's what this issue is about, mootness. Edwards is the only case we could find for the Clean Water Act dealing with mootness. Now, granted, it's a little different because it was the defendant that died in that case. But the district court in Edwards went through the three-factor test, determined that the primary purpose of the Clean Water Act is to protect the public. The second factor, the fines, civil penalties, even in a citizen suit, go to the government. The third factor, the court really didn't address in Edwards, but when you look at the other cases, the civil and criminal penalties under the Clean Water Act may seem substantial, but I will tell you in my experience, I've prosecuted water pollution cases both civilly and criminally, and all of those defendants thought it was penal.
Well, sure.
I don't know.
Like, if you levy a fine or, the fact that a defendant feels that they are being punished doesn't tell me a lot, but okay.
$25,000 versus, $250. The court in Edwards looked at the legislative history of the Clean Water Act, and there are some differences here. I mean, we're dealing with a permit regulation versus Edwards, I believe, was a wetlands issue. Civil penalty provision, a little different, but they looked at the legislative history of the penalty provision. They looked at the U.S. EPA policy on penalties, and they concluded that the civil penalty provision in the Clean Water Act was penal and didn't survive a claim where the government was bringing it against. Now, first, it was his wife who substituted for him, but she later inherited the property, and in that case, the U.S. government amended the complaint. So she wasn't sitting as a substitute for Edwards in that case. She was a defendant and could have been held responsible for those civil penalties. This case is different. They didn't indicate when they moved to substitute Mr. Cox's wife for him where she lived, that they didn't own the property anymore. I would ask, if they're going to submit an affidavit trying to establish that she has standing on her own, that this court grant the county leave to respond to that, because that should have been potentially done in the first place.
Mr. Cox's standing wasn't based just on his house. He was involved in trying to clean up the waters.
And it's my understanding they're going to try to submit an affidavit saying Mrs. Cox does the same thing. And so I think that we should have a chance to respond to that.
But it's a survivability issue. She's not claiming. She's stepping into his shoes as the PR.
And we will see if they cite any case law that says that when you stand in somebody's shoes, that standing doesn't matter. I understand. Standing is at the point of the complaint.
Yeah. It's interesting that there aren't a lot of cases on this question, but it does seem odd to me that a rule of appellate procedure could trump Article 3, but maybe that's the way it works. Maybe you should move on, unless there are more questions about standing or mootness. Well, maybe a different question about mootness.
Do you, first of all, do you think that the proper analysis was under the
Edwards case?
No, I'm not talking about that. The judge applied the diligent prosecution. Is that what the phrase is? Okay. Applied that test. Was that the proper test? Because I thought that, by its statutory terms, applied to bringing a suit.
No, so yeah, we raised the diligent prosecution defense in a motion to dismiss, and as the court explained in his later opinion regarding the motion for summary judgment, he initially denied some of that, because when he just compared the five counts of the state versus the nine counts in Mr. Cox's complaint, he said that there wasn't overlap on some of those counts.
Which was correct.
And then when you bring the consent order back into the play, and I would suggest that when the consent order is analyzed against the nine, in this case, three claim, or six claims that are still standing, 1 through 37 through 9, the analysis suggests that the state's enforcement action was diligently prosecuting those same affluent standards and limitations as the claims made by Mr. Cox. And essentially what we have heard, right, is that the issue is that Mr. Cox believes that the state's enforcement action isn't aggressive enough because it allows the county to continue to address the, essentially, these are household sewage treatment systems that don't have coverage under a separate NPDES general permit for household sewage treatments in Ohio. But Ohio law requires the Board of Health to allow these systems to be repaired and replaced if they aren't meeting a statutorily defined nuisance under Chapter 3718. And so even Mr. Cox, when he brought this action, and I think this came up earlier, not only does the consent order address all HSTS, requires the county to go forward and identify which ones can be eliminated right now and identify ones they don't even know about and continue to submit schedules to the EPA on what those schedules of when they're going to be eliminated. Now, in the appellate's brief, they don't even give the county credit for the construction of the sewers as part of this consent order. The consent order is going to require the city of Columbus controls the sanitary sewer in Franklin County. Unlike in Hamilton County, where there's a 50-year contract and they have one sewer district between the city and the county, here in Franklin County, the city controls the wastewater. And so I think Stephen Renner's affidavit in the record shows that the county is continuously for the last decade negotiating with the city to expand their opportunities where they can install sanitary sewer for these unincorporated areas that would then be discharged to the city's sewage system, and that eliminates those. And these are long processes, right? First, we have agreements. One of those agreements is Kanawha. And so we're spending the county's spending $10 million to put this system in Mr. Cox's former neighborhood, and they essentially are giving us no credit. These are the easy ones right now. We have the ability.
What is your position on whether the consent order requires you to address the 1,700 non-complying but performing as intended systems?
I think it's clear that under the consent order, the county used to have an IDDE plan.
Used to what?
Used to have an IDDE plan, illicit discharge detection and elimination. Under this, it's required under the NPDES permit. And the plan for Franklin County before this lawsuit and before this consent order said that Franklin County Public Health could make the determination as to whether or not a system that was operating as intended and designed was an illicit discharge. The EPA made them remove that. Those systems are illicit discharges. The issue is, how do you eliminate them? The permit in Ohio, recognizing the law in Ohio that makes it a requirement for the Board of Health to let these older systems be repaired, does incorporate that language. That language in the permit is also incorporated into the consent order. Mr. Cox's expert testified in response to my question about that section, 3718.012, and he said, it's the property owner's duty to comply and get coverage under the NPDES general permit for HSTS. Under the permit for MS4s, it's the county's duty to inform them. So essentially, how is this county going to address the remaining, right? We're negotiating with the city. We're going to try to get opportunities to build new sewers. The Board of Health is actively conducting their operation and maintenance program, annually inspecting all of these, and they can eventually find that they aren't able to fix themselves, and then they have to be replaced, and then they have to be updated to a system that is compliant with the NPDES general permit.
How long are you allowing them?
So the plan and schedule that was submitted to EPA, and it is in the record, it has till 2033, I believe. So initially, the steps are, and I think it really the first requirement that they got to give these notices out is in January of next year. And I'm glad that you brought up that date, because opposing counsel mentioned and tried to make an issue saying that the 2019 report that's in the record somehow goes against the consent order. The consent order was issued and granted in the court in January of 2020. So I'm not sure that those requirements hadn't been in place for the prior year's report.
Do you agree that there are certain claims that aren't satisfied by the consent order?
Absolutely not. We went through in our motion for summary judgment, and we believe that Judge Graham analyzed that very well, went claim for claim, and the issue is that they are overlapping.
And why does the diligent prosecution provision apply when, by its terms, and the cases say, it only addresses the right to bring a complaint? It doesn't address the effect of the county's subsequent conduct. So how does it all of a sudden operate to bar their claim?
No, I think you're getting to the point where I think they raised this issue that Judge Graham rewrote the consent order so that it would comply with the, so that it didn't go beyond the state's complaint. On that issue, I would say that the case law cited by the appellant on that matter, the facts don't support that finding. If you look,
I just think maybe you're misunderstanding Judge White's question. So if I'm wrong about this, was he answering your question the way?
No, I was just going to say, I'm asking you a different question, and this wasn't necessarily raised by the parties. But the statute on diligent prosecution explicitly bars a complaint. I mean, that's what it says. So I don't understand how that statute is applied to dismiss this claim, not based on, it doesn't refer to dismissing claims other than saying that you can't bring the complaint. And the judge went through that and found that the complaint was proper. So how does this this conduct, this decree, how does it justify dismissing the complaint? Now, I can understand if you're making a mootness argument, but other than that, I don't see how the diligent prosecution applies at that point.
I believe that Judge Graham's analysis of the case law as it relates to the diligent prosecution bar follows that to suggest that the state's enforcement action, as long as they are diligently prosecuting them, bars, and I understand what you're saying, the complaint, but it bars the plaintiff action. It bars the citizen suit. And so those claims are prevented through the diligent prosecution.
What case are you relying on? where it was a consent decree that ended the case or resulted in a dismissal of what was previously determined to be a proper case?
There's a lot of cases in this matter. I can't come up with one off the top of my head, Your Honor.
I just think maybe what Judge White is saying is that the frame is not, the diligent prosecution frame is not the right frame. Maybe the way to think about this is that the claim, if everything has been satisfied, whether the complaints overlapped or not at the outset, that's the diligent prosecution question. Now that there's a consent decree, maybe the question is mootness, a different kind of mootness than we were talking about at the beginning, but the claim is moot because it's not redressable. There is a case that we found called Ehler versus City of Maynardville from the Sixth Circuit that seems to frame it as mootness. But again, I'm not going to ask you to, I asked your opposing counsel to talk about a case that I sprung on him. I'm not going to do the same to you, although don't get mad at me for being unfair. Because we are, I think we've pretty much exhausted your time unless there are more questions.
I just have one last question.
Yeah, okay.
The issue, of course, has been repeatedly stated is whether the consent decree provides all the relief that the plaintiff was looking for. Counsel said something, and I may have misunderstood him, but is there any issue, this deals, of course, with the HSTS's discharging into the MS4?
Correct.
Is there any issue as to discharges from the MS4?
This idea that that would be a violation of the Clean Water Act. So they have a permit, right? So they have a permit, and so permits actually shield them when there is pollutants. Now, the difficulty with these stormwater permits, right, is the county is many, many miles, and their stormwater system aren't storm tiles that the counties put out there. They're drainage ditches next to township roads, and you have all these households with sewage systems that are discharging. Whether or not the affidavits would suggest sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't, where's the water going? And so is the issue that there is a discharge from a point source into the waters of the state, is that a violation of this permit? I think it is not. It actually suggests in the permit, if during dry weather screening they find this discharge, then they have a duty to go up and find the household sewage treatment or illegal dumping that's taking place and eliminate that, Your Honor.
I understand how you feel about the issue, but Is the issue of discharges from MS4 properly included in the plaintiff's complaint?
Did they make that allegation?
Well, I say I may have misunderstood what counsel said, but I understood it to say that the consent decree didn't address that issue.
Yeah. Well, I think the consent decree addresses that issue to the extent that we are dealing with the entire system. These are programmatic plans and schedules, and they address all of the household sewage treatment systems that are in Franklin County that are known about. And the duty is to now treat them as illicit discharges and to eliminate them.
Thank you, counsel.
Judge White, did you have one more?
So are you saying that all of the claims in Cox's complaint have been addressed, including these illicit discharges, and the only dispute is the timetable?
I am, Your Honor. I don't believe that Mr. Cox thought that the state's enforcement action was aggressive enough, but I don't think that makes the state's diligent prosecution not a bar to the claims that were raised by Mr. Cox.
Okay.
Thank you. We'll hear rebuttal.
I'd first like to address the question that Judge Guy asked, which is, I think there are two questions. One is, are the illicit discharges under the permit unlawful? Were they properly before the court? And are they addressed under the consent order? The answer to the question about whether they're unlawful under the permit is a resounding yes. These 2,000 HSTSs that are discharging into the MS4, and the record shows they're doing it without their own permit, so they're discharging sewage. Now, the MS4 permit itself defines that to be illicit, and when that results in sewage coming out of the system, that is also an illegal and illicit discharge, and the permit makes clear on the receiving end and on the end of it when it's coming out of the system that it's only supposed to be handling stormwater. And that's because it can't treat sewage. That's the whole purpose of this type of scheme. And as for the second question about the outfalls, and if you look at the consent order, there's nothing. Mr. Cox in his complaint identified dozens of outfalls that these illicit sewage discharges were coming out of. I mean, you can review our complaint in a district court case. Dozens, and alleged they were ongoing. We put on evidence in the record that they were ongoing. There's nothing that requires anything to be done at these outfalls in the consent order. Okay, and so there still is much more to be done on the illicit discharges, contrary to what Mr. Durham may have suggested. And then, Judge White, you asked the question about whether the consent order will address all 2,000 of the HSTSs. And I think the answer that we heard is indicative of the problem that we've had that is not addressed by the consent order and that only Mr. Cox has sought to enforce. Again, we heard today the county attempting to use the health department as a shield for the county commissioners, who are the permit holder, meeting their full obligations under the Water Act. And he talked about, well, we'll identify some nuisances over time and eventually maybe we'll get some things done. But what there wasn't was any kind of statement that we are going to eliminate 2,000. And that's because Mr. Durham and the county know that when you look at this consent order, there's nothing in there that requires them to do that. And so therefore, that's why it's not moot. And why there's more remaining to be done. And then the third point I want to make is that, if I may, is that the county is acting as if the case automatically ends when a citizen plaintiff dies. But that just isn't. I mean, the whole purpose of survivability is that Ms. Cox, if she's a proper representative, as Judge White said, she assumes his standing. And she, as a citizen plaintiff, just as Mr. Cox could do on behalf and as representative of his estate, can pursue litigation costs, can pursue the full remedy for the $1,700.
Now you're confusing me.
Sure.
Because I thought that your position is she is just the personal representative of his estate, not that she's a citizen plaintiff in her own right.
If I suggested that she was a citizen plaintiff in her own right, I misspoke, Your Honor. I'm saying that she is assuming his role and assuming his standing when he was the citizen plaintiff, and she's empowered to get all the relief as the representative of his estate, all the relief that Mr. Cox could have gotten before he died. So I will correct.
Just ask you one more. I just keep getting stuck on this Article 3 point. So let's take a case far afield, but I think, pretty easy. So let's say that we have a prisoner, and he sues for injunctive relief. He says the conditions in the prison violate the Eighth Amendment, they're unconstitutional, and he has a wife who's outside of the prison. So he sues for injunctive relief, saying change the conditions in the prison, and then he tragically dies.
Mm-hmm.
She's not in prison and will likely never be in prison. Your position is that claim would survive even though she will never be, it's prospective relief. What are the conditions in the prison? Is it your view that that claim would survive? And if the answer is no, why is your case different than that case?
Yeah, my position on that particular case is that under those circumstances, it likely wouldn't survive.
Because she wouldn't be personally injured, so she wouldn't have Article 3 standing, because you could improve the food in the prison or the housing conditions or whatever, and it won't ever affect her.
I don't know that it's because of Article 3 standing. It would be because there's no further relief that could be granted. Now, but in the Meek, I would call the court's attention to the Meek decision, which is where you're looking just as what's happening here at a dual purpose to the original case. So in Meek, the petitioner in a bankruptcy estate died, mm-hmm. and when the petitioner died, they allowed somebody to be substituted in for the petitioner, and the reason why that was allowed to be done is because the relief being sought wasn't entirely personal to the petitioner. There was a dual purpose. It was for the petitioner and to benefit the public, and the petitioner...
But also, the petitioner's estate, right? So if the petitioner is a bankrupt and he gets relief in bankruptcy, then the heirs don't owe the debt.
Yes. Under Meek, though, what the court relied on was that there was a dual purpose to the original case, that the petitioner was representing the interests of the creditors, just as Mr. Cox was originally doing on behalf of the entire public, and just as in Meek, there is a benefit that's going to still inure to the estate, which we've talked about with respect to the litigation costs, the attorney's fees, certainly the litigation costs So I think Meek and these other cases where there's a dual purpose, where you're just like a citizen suit, where you've got that dual purpose and there's something that's a torch that can still be carried on and that the court can use for... To effectuate the purposes of the statute. Under those circumstances, survivability is pretty clear under both Meek and, I think, under the Murphy factors. And I certainly would refer the court to our briefing on the Murphy factors, and I'm sure when we file a response tomorrow, we'll provide further analysis of that point.
Any more questions? Thank you.